86th episode of Reverse Reverendum. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Terry Chad.
It's 58 years to the day since Australia's first televised test match, and England's Trevor Bailey christened the occasion with a 6-hour 68, using up an astonishing 425 balls. Welcome to the podcast that is proud to continue in the tradition of making cricket as exciting as paint drying.
And so in the 86th episode of Reverse Prep Radio, we have paint drying in the format of a number of intriguing things. We're going to be looking back over a few of the developments in the game over the last couple of weeks. I'm going to be talking about a particularly famous photo that I was very happy to stumble across in a museum in Canberra just a couple of days ago, and we're going to be reviewing Mitchell Johnson's autobiography Resilient, that is hot off the press, came out just a couple of months ago. So Andy, it's been 3 or 4 weeks since we last podcasted. What's been on your mind since then in the cricketing world?
Well, there's been a lot of attention in the last week or so given to a series of new proposals that have come out of the MCC's World Cricket Committee. So these have included recommendations around sendings off being an option for umpires. They've involved recommendations on the reduction of bat sizes. But whether you agree or not with the actual ideas, what I found very encouraging about this is that a body like the World Cricket Committee still exists. It's an independent body of former players and umpires, and some really impressive luminaries there. You've got Mike Brearley as the chair, you've got McCullum, Sangakkara, Ricky Ponting's on there. And I think it's just good to know that even though it's an advisory group, they can't make any of these decisions final, but it's great that cricket is in the fortunate position of having this impressive group engaging hard with the game's evolution, thinking really seriously about the issues.
And what actual power do they have to, I mean, obviously they can make recommendations and sort of talk from the sidelines, but what actual power do they have to be able to actually sort of force anything to be implemented? So they're run by the MCC, are they? I have to admit to being almost completely ignorant of their existence. So they're run by the MCC. They're obviously not part of the ICC, so they're simply making recommendations rather than actually in any way starting the ball rolling in terms of changing legislation or anything.
Yeah, I mean, we could get into a very long, and I must admit, I'm that there is this complex relationship between the MCC as custodian of the laws and the ICC now increasingly as the implementer of those laws. But historical precedent suggests that actually generally when this group advises, and generally the media attention, the respect they get, their proposals do get taken seriously. And I think in a lot of cases, they often set the ball rolling on a lot of these ideas. And you're quite right that they have no power to make them happen instantly. But I think generally it's likely that they will set a trend that the ICC will follow. I think it's interesting, particularly on something like bat sizes, which has been an issue that's been banging around the game for ages. And they have been the first group, as far as I know it, to come up with a very definitive and clear proposal around sizes, and you know, which would actually involve the introduction of gauges used to actually measure bats before games, which, you know, it does sound a little bit extreme, but for something that people have been moaning about for a long time, this is actually a solid concrete proposal. So
it does seem like quite a brilliantly comical idea, actually, the idea of having, you know, how they have those little things that you have to fit the ball through when they think the ball has been misshapen. They have to fit them through the thing. You can imagine them having a thing that you have to fit your bat through before you can actually go out to bat.
Away from the business of, you know, the laws of the game, you've been able to take advantage of living, well, within a stone's throw of one of the world's most famous cricket grounds.
Yeah, so I've always kind of, since moving to Sydney about 3 years ago, I've always lived in the eastern suburbs, and always, you know, in reasonably close to the SCG. But actually, a flat that I moved into a few weeks ago has, I can see the floodlights of the SCG from my, you know, basically from my bed. Well, not really from my bed. You know, if I kind of lean off the side of my bed, I could probably see them. But you get the idea. And one of the annoying things about the SCG is that there is barely any cricket that's actually ever played there. So there are usually only 3 or 4 games a year that are played there, and that's actually across all forms of cricket. So you would think that it was this great, you know, vibrant scene, and you'd have Sheffield Shield games and all kinds of, you know, lower level grade games all the way through to the internationals. But actually, there are only really 3 or 4 a year. So obviously, I the opportunity to go and see Australia play New Zealand in the first of the one days of the series that's going on at the moment as we speak. Actually, yesterday evening Australian time, Australia wrapped up that series 3-0 pretty comprehensively. And actually, the game that I saw at the SCG last Sunday afternoon evening was a bit of a damn squib in the end. Australia set a big total, 300 plus, and then New Zealand's chase sort of never really got going. But it was one of those great reminders that, you know, particularly with the way that we were sort of sandwiched in the stands between a group of Kiwi guys who were in their they must have been in their early 50s, who, you know, once a year they all got back together, they're all school friends, they all got back together and then came across to Australia to watch some form of Australian New Zealand cricket on one side, and then on the other side a friend of mine and my girlfriend, both of whom my girlfriend never having been to a cricket game before, and you know, she sent a cynical tweet halfway through saying that, you know, what a boring thing it was, but I actually was also quite by the whole thing. And actually it was a reminder of the brilliance of actually just going to a live game of cricket and the ability of that to bring together a kind of whole range of people around the game, which is quite easy to forget when actually we end up seeing so little live cricket. I mean, I don't know the last time you went to a live game, but, you know, however much we, you know, follow the game, it's actually often very difficult to get to the live game of it.
I think the other point you make is that there are a lot of people who don't love the sport but who love a day at the cricket. You know, this is the other thing, that live experience.
Exactly.
You know, it's one thing to follow the sport obsessively, which is an absolute joy, but there's also just a real pleasure, as you make the point, of just the experience, the occasion. And I think
the whole atmosphere, drinking the mid-strength beer as they now have in Australian games. You can only get mid-strength beer, which is a kind of watered-down pale imitation of, you know.
Oh, really? I'm sure a lot of that sort of trickery and chicanery goes on at grounds all over the world. They know what they're doing.
They want to charge double for less.
Yeah, they want to keep selling you it, but they don't really want to have to mop you off the floor at the end of the day. It's lovely as well what you said about the group of New Zealand friends. I think it's a key role that sport plays, isn't it? These annual fixtures then become annual fixtures in social calendars as well. It'll be that occasion when people get together.
Now, tell me about the latest news in the Scottish cricket team.
Right, well, this is not...
Because you'll have to forgive me for not being aware of this.
So this is not a story that you would normally expect to attract any attention, but Preston Momsen, the captain of the Scottish cricket team, has retired at the age of just 29. And the fact that it has actually attracted a lot of comment on social media and a lot of attention on Crick Info is due to the fact that it's being seen as a very clear indictment of the way in which the game of cricket is failing the associate nations. To summarise, Momsen basically came out and said, look, we don't play any cricket, or we barely play any cricket, and I just can't see a path to develop in the game, so I'm going off to have a career in business. He gave an extremely eloquent interview on the subject, and one of the key points he made is he said, look, you cannot let us come to a World Cup once in every 4 years, get humiliated by the full members, and then tell us how awful we are, and then not give us the chance to improve by playing full members following 4 years. And I thought it was very well expressed, and I thought the frustration was there. There was also a kind of more subtle point, a kind of within the associates point, about the fact that Afghanistan and Ireland are really getting it together. They're playing each other an awful lot more, but they're slightly doing so to the exclusion of the other associates, which is a point that I must admit, as someone who doesn't follow associate cricket particularly closely, was really interesting, because, you know, for those two countries, it's starting to become something more of a success story, but seemingly at the expense of the other associate teams.
And it does kind of shine a light on we talk a fair bit about how, you know, associate cricket and cricket in the non-test playing nations can actually become more established. And actually something like this shines a light on the way that, in a very practical way, actually the reality of being a cricket player in those countries can, you know, be extremely frustrating and actually be not possible ultimately when you don't have a structure when that can work. And actually it is a fundamental thing that the, you know, ICC needs to look at, or indeed the MCC, maybe this new task force that you were telling us about earlier can come together and talk exactly on this thing, because it's actually a really interesting point, and actually, as I say, an opportunity to really highlight that aspect of it, which actually the rest of cricket sort of seems to sort of forget about, other than those moments. You know, at the World Cup, a team comes along and they either get trounced or they pull off an unlikely victory, and then we forget about them. And actually, hopefully, this resignation can be something that will actually highlight some of the issues around it.
Now, you, in contrast to Preston Momsen, are not nearing cricket retirement, hopefully, and are in the midst of your season.
Oh, God, I've been feeling like it, though. Seriously. So we're halfway through the season here, and you know, we talk a bit on this podcast about the joys of being amateurs in the cricket game, and you regale us with your tales of your glorious exploits for Pinkney's Green, and I occasionally is that what it's called? It's a ridiculous name, isn't it?
A proud name with a proud heritage. What a thing to say!
Indeed, there we go. As frequent listeners will know, I play for the ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation team, and it's one of those incredibly frustrating things where the season's been going for about 2.5 months now, and because I've been travelling quite a lot for work, that I haven't really played all that much, and it's just, you know, and you end up, I mean, actually the real problem has been that we've been promoted, and so we're actually playing against quite good other cricketers, and we're a kind of ragbag motley bunch of people who, you know, vaguely know the right end of a bat to hold, but nothing much beyond that, and we generally play for the joy of it. And it continually strikes me how frustrating an experience it is to not play regularly and to play against other good cricketers who are playing regularly, and, you know, they have their Saturday teams as well as their Sunday teams and everything else. And so, you know, for me, there are moments when I suddenly think, you know, you go out and you play against a whole load of, you know, so I'm an opening batsman and play against a whole load of bowlers, and, you know, you get shown up and play a few silly shots and get out for caught on the boundary for 25, you know, innings after innings, and you suddenly think to yourself, why do I do this? What is the point of this? Why do you give up your time on a Sunday afternoon?
And God, you sound like you maybe are nearing retirement here.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Tomorrow morning, so I'll update you after that.
I think the difficulty, and we've all been there, is when you go through one of these runs of form, and I think this is particularly true when you're playing predominantly as a batsman, where if you are out for a lovely Sunday afternoon with your team, but your personal contribution to the team lasts, you know, 5 to 10 minutes, you do then have a lot of introspective time in the field, sort of to look out onto the meadows of Pinkney's Green and wonder what it's all for. But generally, I find the game has a wonderful way of, you know, if not in that very game, then next week you'll have that little thing that'll just lure you back in again. It might be that, you know, you might strike a couple of nice boundaries, take a particularly great catch, and you'll think, I've still got it. And, you know, it's the hope that kills you, isn't it? It brings you back again and again. From the archives, and in this episode, Toby is going to tell us the story of an iconic cricketing image that he stumbled across only yesterday.
Well, actually, it's an image that I've been aware of, I think, sort of vaguely in the back of my head for many years. It's one of those images that you see cropped up all over the place when anyone talks about cricket from yesteryear. And there are a couple of things that brought it to my attention, the first of which is that it features on the front cover of Gideon Hayes' recent biography of Victor Trumper, and indeed it is a picture of Victor Trumper. And as anyone who listens to this podcast will know, we are enormous fans of every single word that Gideon Hay ever writes, or indeed the worship the ground that he walks on. And that indeed is on our reading list, and we haven't quite got round to it. And so I was particularly delighted when I was just yesterday morning in the National Portrait Gallery in Canberra here in Australia, turned a corner, and suddenly there it was in front of me, possibly the most iconic cricket image of all time. And this is the sepia image of Victor Trumper, which if you just Google Victor Trumper photo will be the first thing that comes up. It's side on, he's got his front leg aloft, his eyes are the very picture of concentration set on the ball in front of him, and he's reaching out in front of him with an enormous backlift, with an expectant crowd waiting in the background.
It's an extraordinarily energetic photo. I mean, I'm not a sort of connoisseur or critic of kind of photography, but it sounds like a very odd thing to say, but it's a photo that's kind of full of motion, isn't it? It's kind of as dynamic as you can imagine a photo being.
It is. He's kind of like a sprung coil, I always think, when I look at that picture, actually. You know, you can imagine it. Even though it's a static image, you can imagine exactly what's going to happen after it. It's got all that kind of potential motion bound up on it. And the photographer, George Beldam, when he took the photo, he was really one of the leading cricket photographers of the day, one of the leading photographers of the day. It was taken in the UK, in Bramall Lane up in Sheffield. And it's long been actually acclaimed as probably the perfect cricket photo, simply because of the nature of the composition and the fact that within a static image there is so much motion that is implied. And in a way, that's really what is so significant about the image, the fact that it is just such a beautifully composed image. But there's also a fascinating story behind it, part of which is the fact that it's not quite what it seems. So when you look at it, you assume that it must be the most natural photo that was ever taken. Here's Victor Trumper, the greatest Australian batsman of all time. And I say that in a slightly controversial way, but there are those who certainly would say that he was greater than Don Bradman as a batsman. Here he is in full flight, caught in 1905 in Bramall Lane in a test match in Sheffield. But actually, of course, back in the day, telephoto lenses weren't a thing that really existed. Photography was in its infancy in that time. And so actually the ability to take pictures of that kind was very limited. And so actually when that happened it was effectively staged. So they would go out during the tea break and they would take these images. They would have someone bowl balls and then the batsman would be there and would take the photos of them, and there are a whole series of pictures actually from that game. Some of them are bowlers, some of them are batsmen, some of them are fielders. So there was later on a bit of a controversy over the idea that actually the photo was superimposed. So actually the picture of Trumper was taken separately and then was superimposed onto a picture of a crowd in the background, which it seems isn't true, or at least, you know, the experts say isn't true, and that it was actually taken live. But it was certainly not taken actually during a match, and it was actually a staged shot.
Well, it has that device that you see in quite a lot of modern sports photography, where you have, and again, there perhaps may be a technical term for this within photography, where you have your prime subject in full focus and then the crowd is sort of slightly blurred in the background. And you see this quite a lot often now in modern sports photography, where the classic image you often have is sort of a footballer in celebration, and then him sort of, you know, opening his arms or whatever, and then the crowd slightly blurred behind him. And I guess part of the idea being that, you know, there's the we want all our attention on the true subject here.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a kind of depth of field thing in photography where you have a very shallow depth of field. So you have the subject very sharp and then the background very, very much sort of in the distance. And that is one of the things that's actually quite remarkable about this photo, and actually the conception that George Beldam had around how this photo would be taken was it was cricket in its context. So it wasn't just, because, you know, you have quite a lot of, if you look at any of the early video footage of cricketers, it's all taken out in the middle during the tea break, and it's all very close up, and it's out of context of actually being within the game. So you don't actually get any of that sense of it being part of, you know, these great, you know, great matches with enormous crowds there in the background and the stands and, you know, everything else that's happening. And that's one of the really significant things about this picture, actually, is exactly the fact that it's taken during a game. The other thing that's really significant, and this is one thing that really came across for me when I saw it in the National Portrait Gallery beside two other cricket photos, was the thing that throws it into sharp relief is those other two photos are of, and they are of team photos from about 30 years before. One of them is of the first Australian side to travel internationally, which is actually something that we've talked about in the podcast. This side made up mostly of Indigenous players who went internationally and played cricket, but also, you know, did spear throwing exhibitions during the intervals and stuff like that in a slightly awkward cultural instance in the UK in the late 1880s, I believe. And then the other one is of the first full Indigenous Australian side. And they're just these shots of people just sort of standing there looking at the camera, looking a bit formal, wearing their blazer and everything else. And you really see the difference between the static worlds of what sports photography was and then the real dynamism of this Trumper shot, which must have actually been a real revelation for the people who suddenly, for the first time, were seeing cricketers in full flow. And actually, apparently, according to some of the sort of photography blogs that I've been reading up on about this, actually this is quite new in terms of the way that photography was actually picturing the world at this point, and actually the opportunity for photography to be taking to be representing something in motion rather than someone standing very, very still and looking at a camera. Because of course up to that point, in order to take a photo, someone had to stand very, very still for about 5 minutes while they had the length of time to expose the shot that they were pointing at them.
And this must have been incredibly powerful for the large number of people who would have followed cricket only from afar. So, you know, the idea that you would be reading about Trumper in the papers, but you would never have had the chance to see him play. I mean, this must have really, you know, done an extraordinary thing in terms of capturing the imagination. I guess one of the other things that does make it so iconic is you look at this shot and you look at this stance and you think you could imagine this all being played today, couldn't you? I mean, it's not... There is something about that shot that would look as at home on a 21st... I mean, it's actually quite T20. You have this extraordinary backlift. You can just see that ball is going to get absolutely hammered. In context of our previous conversation about regulation of bat sizes, it's interesting to note that it's a pencil of a bat, isn't it? It's yep. extraordinary yep. how thin it is. You know, you give that to Chris Gayle and see what he would make of it.
No, I completely agree that there's a real timelessness to the nature of the image, actually, and in terms of our ability to relate to it. Because when you think that this was taken in 1905, and you look at a lot of the photography and the film that came out from that era, and actually it looks like a different game. I mean, I always look at footage from then and I think, oh, you know, must have been difficult batting because they could see everything only in black and white. but you also, you look at it and it just looks like the kind of shots that are played, you know, the little dabs, you know, there wasn't much of a driving game. There wasn't much of a sense of getting onto the front foot. And then suddenly you see this shot and you actually realize what it was about Trumper, who was a fundamentally really, really revolutionary batsman who actually grew up not, you know, fewer than, you know, 600, 700 meters from where I'm now talking. And you suddenly realize that really the mark that he had on the game is, you know, in a way equal to the mark that this image has had on the game as well. To the review, and for this episode, we have been reading Mitchell Johnson's autobiography called Resilience. On the inside, fly sheet, I think that's what they call it. They say this: Mitchell Johnson is a once-in-a-generation Australian cricketer, a devastating left-arm fast bowler who became a household name following his epic performance in the 2013-14 Ashes series and the subsequent Test series against South Africa. But behind the cult image and fearsome pace bowling is an unforgettable story of perseverance and persistence. For you, was this an unforgettable story?
I mean, I think unforgettable is a big ask of any book. His story's not a bad story at all. I mean, the unconventional beginning, you have someone who came from not a traditional cricketing family background, someone who, unlike so many international cricketers, wasn't part of the system. He wasn't in the youth teams. He was actually a tennis player, really, as a teenager. And then this.
And I hadn't realised this at all, that he was a tennis player until he was, you know, he first picked up a cricket bat when he was, or a cricket ball when he was 18, I think.
Indeed, and you have this extraordinary thing of how Dennis Lilly, you know, as close to kind of Australian cricketing royalty as it gets, made this incredible spot, really. He saw Mitchell Johnson and fast-tracked him, believing that he had found a once-in-a-generation talent. So there's something very, very Hollywood about that story, and it's also, I think, fascinating that you can find someone that late in their development and they still go on, you know, they still have enough natural talent that the fact that they haven't had those years of practice, those years of cricket behind them, doesn't matter.
And I think that's one of the interesting recurring themes of the book, actually, is as he goes through his international career, and indeed his cricket career, is actually that continuing battle between just being someone who just happens to be able to bowl really, really well, as opposed to someone who's been trained to bowl really, really well. And so actually there are moments when, you know, he breaks down because of physical injury or because of mental injury. And you kind of realize that it's actually what you're taking is raw material and just shoving it into the cauldron of Test cricket or international cricket. And actually, he does not have in any way. And it's something that sort of comes back time and time again and underlies a lot of the story throughout his whole career, is actually that fact that he doesn't have that, as you say, that conventional, that upbringing and that structure around. You know, you read any other cricketer's biography and it's all about, oh, thank you, Mum, you know, at the age of 7, you were driving me to and from training. Johnson's, you know, upbringing was actually, his family upbringing was pretty checkered in a way. And also he just had absolutely none of that in his life.
Yeah, and I think the other side of it, he talks a lot about not really understanding his gift. You know, he had this extraordinary ability to bowl fast, but I think it was a lot later in his career that he was really able to understand the mechanics behind it. But I think in a way it's quite an exciting story, because there's something just nice in the idea that there's a natural ability that can be picked up, that can be discovered in the way Dennis Lilly did, that, you know, not all sporting greatness is kind of manufactured through endless days in academies and village hall nets. I guess the title of the biography, Resilient, which I don't love as a title, but is very much alludes to the fact that his career went through this kind of astonishing mid-career slump, where, having really got to the pinnacle of the game and been seen as one of the great bowlers, his game really fell apart for a while. Both, as you said, there were issues with sort of his mental strength, and there were issues with his body and stuff. And there is, it is kind of a classic Hollywood film setup. You know, hero rises, he falls, and then he comes back again. And that's always going to be quite a satisfying narrative.
There is.
Arc.
There is definitely a question, though, despite that narrative arc, about whether, given that he is someone who, by his own confession, is not a great thinker about the game, and absolutely, you know, HarperCollins got on board, who published this autobiography, got on board Peter Laylor, who is obviously a pretty distinguished cricket journalist, to ghostwrite it for him. But there is a question that you know, crops up throughout the book, which is, what exactly are we reading this for? Mitchell Johnson is not someone who has great insights about the game. His, you know, the story of his career is a reasonably interesting one. I found myself at times skipping through his, I mean, as far as I can tell, he, you know, dedicates at least a page to every single game he's ever played in.
Yeah.
And at times it feels like he's just sort of, you do have to be a little bit, as the title of the book suggests, resilient when actually reading this book, to the constant churn of these games that he's sort of recounting one after another, in which all he really says is, oh, and I got 3 for 25, yeah, and I bowled well, so, and I got a couple of edges behind.
My guess is that the problem you've got as a ghostwriter here is that if you've got a cricketer who is a real thinker about the game, then actually you've got pages and pages where you can talk through their thoughts, their philosophies on the game. If you don't, then you do end up on this treadmill of match reports, and I completely agree with you that at times it just becomes tough, it becomes really heavy going. And I think it's one of the reasons why, you know, we as a podcast, we don't read a huge number of modern, hot off the press biography, autobiographies, or biographies, because they can sort of fall into this pattern. There's also an interesting thing about what he is and isn't willing to reveal about the events he was part of. So obviously, with any biography, the first thing all cricket fans tend to descend on now is, you know, what's the dirt? What happened behind these great incidents? And we do get some stuff. I didn't know, for example, the story of the near coming to blows with Kevin Peterson at Cardiff. At the start of the 2009 Ashes. That was extraordinary, and it also revealed a side of KP that, let's be honest, I think we probably did know. You know, this idea that he was practicing pull shots in such a way that he kept landing the ball right near the practicing Australian fast bowlers, and then obstinately kept doing it when they asked him to stop. I was like, I can recognise that side of KP. But...
And then they came together, the rest of the story being they came together, and KP said to Johnson something that he, in the book, he says he won't dignify with with reprinting, but seems to be something about Johnson's family. You know, his mother, he had a kind of, you know, a relationship with his mother that was fairly troubled, and the implication is that, and, you know, Johnson, in a way, I think quite fairly, doesn't actually just reprint in full and start a whole flame going about, oh, you know, KP said this to me. The thing that I find slightly annoying is that when we get towards the end of the book, and he refers at several times to, after Ricky Ponting resigned as Australian captain, to the breakdown of the Australian team. And actually, there is, you know, and he refers to the fact it just becomes a more difficult place to play in. But there is never a point at which he actually really pinpoints what it was that was more difficult or anything else. And, you know, to be honest, in a little bit of a kind of, you know, gossip mongering way, I was actually quite looking forward to reading all about that and finding out about all the stuff that had been going on in the dressing rooms and, you know, Michael Clarke falling out with everyone, etc., etc. And there's absolutely none of that throughout the entire thing, which is interesting. But perhaps that is understandable because there are other parts of the book that explain how thoroughly Johnson has been burnt by the press and by public opinion throughout his career as well.
And that is an area where actually I think I did learn something with this book, because we all know the treatment the Barmy Army gave him, and we all know how actually that clearly did affect him. He got over it by the end of his career, and I think, you know, by the time he actually came to England for the last time, I think he dealt with it very well. He was the senior bowler and he laughed it off. But what I found shocking wasn't that, because we know that story, we know the song. It was what he used to get away from the stadium. And there's a very interesting anecdote about how he goes out for drinks with a friend of his who's an Australian serviceman who's won the Medal of Honour in Afghanistan. And this soldier is staggered by the level of abuse that Johnson takes when he's just going to the pub and he's just going out. And I remember thinking that I could clearly in my head, I think I can draw sort of a moral line between, okay, you can expect to cop something in the ground, but the idea that you should be going out for a beer and putting up with that is sad, actually. I can't finish this review without highlighting a couple of lines which I felt, as well as being glorious comic, also suggest a complete lack of a sense of irony. So Mitchell Johnson talks and says, "I hated seeing my private life played out in the press." And then, without skipping a beat, "Unfortunately, Jess and I had signed a 12-month deal with a women's magazine, and I was obliged to give them some quotes." Now, you can either read this as extreme naivety or a very strong sense of not knowing that when you try to cash in your private life, people will necessarily expect a little bit of it back in return.
So that is the 86th episode of Reverse Rep Radio. Here we are cashing in on our opinions on cricket and hoping that you will give us something in return. You can always tell us what you want. Either when you bump into us in the bar, you can sledge us like the Barmy Army did Mitchell Johnson, or you can find us on Twitter at Reverse Swept. We'll be back probably after Christmas now in the new year with more of Reverse Swept Radio. Thank you for listening.